they're constantly doing checks on the officers out in the field. Hey, is everybody doing okay? Does anybody need a break? That kind of thing.
Since Monday, Anchorage police deal with three separate incidents of armed standoffs. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, part four in the Pipeline Promises series brings the voices of gas line naysayers.
The idea that somehow the state of Alaska has discovered that by borrowing money, the project could be made cheaper, that doesn't make any sense.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Two officers have been wounded by gunshots from a barricaded suspect in an ongoing standoff in South Anchorage. The Anchorage Police Department says one of the officers is being treated at a nearby hospital and is expected to live. The other was treated on scene. The active standoff has been going on for well over a day and began Wednesday morning after the suspect on Janami Street fired shots at two men trimming nearby trees. Later that same day, the suspect fired at police as they were preparing to deploy gas. So far, efforts at getting the man to surrender have failed. Speaking from the scene, police spokesperson Jennifer Castro says she doesn't recall a standoff lasting this long.
The environment that we're dealing with here is a little bit different than a lot of the ones that we traditionally respond to as far as barricaded subjects. We have a much larger residence with a lot more things spread out.
The suspect has been identified as 69-year-old Robert Musser. Castro declined to specify what kind of firearm was used against the two officers. For much of the day, a separate standoff was happening at a house on Misty Springs Court, not far from the University of Alaska Anchorage campus. Around a dozen members of law enforcement, including personnel from the Federal Bureau of Investigation SWAT team, were on hand and convinced 29-year-old Joseph Sikowski to surrender this afternoon. Castro says most of APD's SWAT resources were already at the Janami standoff, along with members of the state troopers, and that personnel are being steadily rotated in and out.
They're constantly doing checks on the officers out in the field. Hey, is everybody doing okay? Does anybody need a break? That kind of thing. So we try really hard to make sure that everyone is functioning and capable.
The SWAT team has been called out three times this week, starting with a standoff in Eagle River on Monday. Asked whether there's been why there's been such a tight cluster of similar incidents for over so few days, Castro was clear.
That's a great question. We have no idea.
This is an ongoing story. Check our website for updates. Earlier this week, we heard Governor Bill Walker make the case that his new gas line plan will finally get the project off the drawing board and into the ground. But it's not hard to find skeptics who say Walker is just creating more paperwork. For the final story in our series, Pipeline Promises, we sent Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk to talk to the governor's critics.
As a new reporter in Alaska, it didn't take long for me to notice that even though state leaders are always talking about the gas line, there's something left unsaid. I mentioned this to Larry Pershley, a gas line expert who now advises the Kenai Peninsula Borough.
It seemed to be this, like, unstated truth that a lot of people don't believe this is going to happen. This
right.
may
oh,
not
yes.
even materialized.
Right. And even a couple years ago when AKLNG looked like, hey, there was people still, oh, it won't happen.
Right. And okay. being a new Alaskan.
Do you have a dog yet?
No dog yet. So this new Alaskan set out to learn why so many people think the governor's plan is, well, doomed. Skeptics like Pershley see some big forces working against the project. The biggest is the market. This is an expensive project aimed at supplying a product, gas, that today is plentiful and cheap.
Prices for the commodity are down. The project is one of the most expensive energy projects ever in the history of the world. So that alone would make a lot of people skeptical. They look at the price tag, look at what you're going to get for the product at the end, and they say, Oh, that's not going to happen. Turn the TV back on.
These lousy market conditions help explain why the big oil companies are stepping back from the effort to build the gas line. And this plays into another big issue skeptics bring up, one that becomes clear as I walk into the office of Republican State Senator Kathy Geisel. We talk sitting between stacks of cardboard boxes. That's because oil-dependent Alaska can't afford the legislature's sleek new building. So lawmakers are moving. The governor argues Alaska's dire fiscal situation is one more reason to charge ahead. Geisel says it's a reason to be cautious. Sure, she'd love to see the gas line built.
At the same time, we have a significant budget challenge right now. And I think that we can overplay our hand and find ourselves in an even worse fiscal predicament if we act rashly.
Geisel's not sure the state has the capacity to manage the project, and she's also not sure how much it's going to cost to build that capacity. She says more state control means the state's taking on more risk. Walker's plan is for the state to bring in money from outside investors rather than relying on the oil companies to pay for most of the gas line. In late August, energy analyst David Barrowman of Wood Mackenzie told lawmakers that, in theory, elements of Walker's proposal are promising.
Currently, Alaska LNG, in terms of global competitiveness, is quite challenged. But there are levers that can be used.
Those levers, he said, are exactly the levers Walker is trying to pull to reduce the project's price tag, attracting third-party investors and avoiding some federal taxes. But the next day, the legislature's energy consultant, Nikos Safos, took his turn before lawmakers and really tore the governor's plan apart.
If it's an uneconomic project, all you've done is just taken it over, which is, you usually want to take over economic projects, not uneconomic projects.
One of Safos' critiques is this idea of outside investors. The oil companies, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, worry their investment in a gas line wouldn't pay a high enough return. The governor says, fine, the state can find outside investors, like, say, pension funds, that would require less of a profit on the project and finance it more cheaply. Safos told me he's not sure investors like this actually exist.
Right, I mean, borrowing money, everyone borrows money, right? The idea that somehow the state of Alaska has discovered that by borrowing money, the project could be made cheaper, that doesn't make any sense, right?
Safos says he looked at other projects around the world and can't find many examples of the kind of investors the governor has in mind backing LNG projects, much less at this massive scale and this early in the game. And Safos doubts they'll accept less profit than the oil companies. Walker also wants to make the pipeline cheaper by avoiding some federal taxes. A lot of state projects like, say, roads, don't pay federal taxes because they benefit the public. The governor argues if Alaska leads the way, it can make a case that part of the project won't owe the IRS a check. But this project will involve private interests, potentially some of the wealthiest companies in the world. Here's Larry Persley again.
This is not a school or a highway for general public use. This is a private undertaking where 95% of the gas is going to go not just outside of Alaska, but overseas.
After hearing all this skepticism, I started to wonder, what's the downside? What if this project doesn't work? Will the state lose billions of dollars? Will I have to pack up my bags and move back to D.C.? And everybody told me, calm down. Walker is taking one step in what's going to be a very long journey. Will it cost some money? Sure. And that's important to pay attention to at a time when every dollar for the gas line is one that doesn't go into other state services. But Persley says it's nothing compared to the hundreds of millions of dollars the state has spent on this project in the past.
If that's what it takes to put this to rest, if that's the political price of this, maybe that's the way we've got to go.
Persley gives it a 10, maybe 20% chance of it working. But he's not losing any sleep over it. Meanwhile, the governor will spend the next year making the case to the public, lawmakers, and the market about why he thinks his skeptics are wrong. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
That's the final story in our series on the state's quest to build a natural gas pipeline. To hear the full series, Pipeline Promises, connect with Alaska's Energy Desk on Facebook. The Permanent Fund Corporation has rejected a proposal from Governor Bill Walker's administration to invest in state oil tax credits. Former Attorney General Craig Richards presented the idea to the board earlier this month. The administration is looking for ways to ease the pain for smaller oil companies after the governor vetoed $430 million in credits that companies expected this year. But the Permanent Fund Board said in a statement that the projected returns do not justify taking on the associated risks. The Fairbanks police chief is on administrative leave today. The city issued a release yesterday saying Chief Randall Aragon is on paid administrative leave while the city looks into conflict of interest charges. The release states Deputy Chief Brad Johnson will be acting chief during the investigation. At its meeting Monday, the Fairbanks City Council heard a complaint from the former police chief that Aragon used his office to his own advantage. The complaint says Aragon told a merchant seeking a Fairbanks police security review of her business that officers were too busy. The complaint says Aragon then told the merchant his private security business could do the work for $600. Several Fairbanks council members Monday called for an independent review, including Councilman Jim Matherly. He says an internal investigation is too close to home.
I think this rises above that level considerably. This is a look of impropriety from a chief of police. So to me, it's a bigger scale.
Matherly is also running for city mayor, but denies his concerns have anything to do with politics.
If I didn't speak, didn't say it as a councilman, people would say, why aren't you talking? You need to represent us.
Chief Aragon is out of town at the FBI training facility. Mayor John Eberhardt says he's been counseled not to talk about the investigation while it is underway. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Senator Murkowski pushes for bills that have little chance for traction this year.
One way or another, it probably won't be with this administration, but one way or another, the people of King Cove are going to find safety.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski this morning brought some of her most controversial Alaska bills to the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, which she chairs. There are only a few legislative days left before Congress takes a recess for the election. The controversial bills stand almost no chance of becoming law in this Congress. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Murkowski hopes some can still pack a punch.
The most ambitious of the bills Murkowski brought to the committee reads like the Alaska delegation's master wish list, the things they've been trying to convince Congress to pass for decades. The bill would open part of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. It would mandate lease sales west of the refuge in the National Petroleum Reserve and offshore. In the Tongass National Forest, it would allow new roads and carve out a new state forest. Murkowski says Alaska needs to develop these federal resources.
Right now, we're facing pretty much a brick wall of opposition in these areas.
Conservation groups and their Senate allies sound the alarm whenever efforts like these seem close to passage. This did not appear to be one of those times. The top Democrat on the committee, Maria Cantwell of Washington, objected, but only dryly.
Similarly, I've fought for many years to protect the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, the Tongass National Forest, and important conservation lands in Alaska, which are important to all Americans.
Murkowski later told reporters in a phone conference that some of the provisions are intended to stake out her position on new oil production, for instance, for this administration or the next. One of her bills calls for the Interior Secretary to develop a plan to add 500,000 barrels of oil per day to the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
Okay, we know that that's not something that we're going to see. It's not going to happen within that Congress. That is certainly telling the next administration, I want to see what your plan is. Here's our plan here.
The senator says other provisions are realistic before President Obama leaves office. She cited the Alaska Mental Health Trust land trade. It would allow the trust to get land in the Tongass to avoid logging near Ketchikan and Petersburg. Murkowski saved most of her passion for the long-discussed King Cove Road. It would connect King Cove to an all-weather airport at Cold Bay, but it would go through the Eisenbeck Wildlife Refuge. Murkowski keeps count of the number of emergency medical evacuations King Cove residents have had to endure since 2013, when Interior Secretary Sally Jewell rejected a land trade for the road. It's 52 so far. Jewell wasn't at the hearing, so Murkowski gave BLM Director Neil Kornsey a message to deliver to the secretary and to the president.
Under their watch, people have been living in fear, in trepidation, and with pain and suffering that could have been addressed. It's unexcusable, and I'm not backing down on this. One way or another, it probably won't be with this administration, but one way or another, the people of King Cove are going to find safety. That's the message that you can take back.
I will.
Murkowski says she knows the administration is just running out the clock so it can wash its hands of King Cove. But with her words and bills, she aims not to let them forget it. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A lawsuit challenging an upcoming Matanuska-Susitna Borough ballot initiative could stall a vote on banning commercial marijuana in the valley. As Alaska Public Media's Ellen Lockyer reports, borough attorneys argue the suit could wreak havoc with the borough's October 4th election.
One of two pot-related lawsuits filed earlier this month against the Matanuska-Susitna Borough alleges the borough is asking voters to decide on an initiative regarding the ban of retail cannabis in violation of state statutes. The suit also alleges election fraud. The plaintiffs have asked the court for an injunction against the initiative. The suit, filed by Rhonda Marcy and Thomas Hannum, say state statutes require local land use issues to be decided by local government planning and zoning boards, and cites legal precedents upholding the state mandate for a planning commission review of land use ordinances. Matsu Borough attorney Nicholas Spiropoulos filed a response and a cross motion for some summary judgment in the case on Monday. Spiropoulos would not go on record for this story, citing an active court case. The borough's response to the suit denies all allegations that the borough acted outside the law in putting the initiative on the upcoming ballot. Cynthia Franklin, who heads the state's Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, says although her board is neutral on the outcome, it is watching the suit closely. Franklin says the 2014 state ballot measure that legalized marijuana in Alaska allows for local governments to opt out.
We're watching it. Our agency and board is not a party to the lawsuit. Our take on a local option is that it's contained in the ballot measure, and the board wrote a whole set, a whole article of regulations around local option. And our experience on the alcohol side with the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board is that communities will opt out and potentially opt back in and opt back out. And over the years, communities can change their minds about these things.
The plaintiffs are representing themselves and are asking the court to force the initiative off the October 4th borough ballot. In the 35-page suit, the plaintiffs allege the proposed borough initiative represents a taking of private property and challenges the borough's zoning power while raising questions regarding constitutional restrictions on the power of initiative. In its response, the borough admits zoning by initiative is invalid, but denies that the borough ballot proposition is a zoning ordinance. The borough also denies the plaintiff's allegations of election fraud. Former Matsu Borough Mayor Larry DeVilbiss and 14 other individuals who sponsored the initiative have been named in the suit. In a borough response opposing the plaintiff's request for an injunction, Spiropoulos wrote that if granted, quote, it will virtually destroy the Matanuska-Susitna Borough's ability to conduct a clear and organized election and will jeopardize the accuracy and the results of all other questions on the ballot. absentee borough ballots went out on Monday. The borough has asked the court for expedited oral argument in the case. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Providence Hospital in Anchorage is donating nearly $1 million to programs focused on ending homelessness. Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports.
The announcement was made Wednesday to mild surprise and light applause at the Assembly's Committee on Homelessness. A representative from the hospital explained how they decided to strategically direct $975,000 toward various charities and social service programs. The city's homelessness coordinator, Nancy Burke, says the funds will go towards padding out existing programs, for example, $60,000 to RuralCap for transitional family housing. And in other cases, it's extra money for programs that are fairly new, like $75,000 to a landlord risk pool used in lieu of security deposits for those in critical need of housing.
It's like oil in the system because so many of the programs are functioning on very tight budgets. The state's reducing. There haven't been increases for grants for many years. And so having a little bit of extra resource in the system to do new things is really valuable.
Though Providence has previously made funds available for individual grants, Burke says this is the first time she can recall the hospital proactively coordinating with service providers like this. Part of the reason, she explains, is that the hospital hopes to divert people away from repeated emergency room treatment by investing in solutions to house and rehabilitate individuals. Burke says the move comes amid a broader change in how the municipality pays for services for the most vulnerable residents.
To really change the thinking, we have to change how the money comes into the system also. So I think Providence stepping forward and saying they're willing to do this is very significant.
Though the majority of funds are going straight to service providers, a large chunk is being distributed through the United Way of Anchorage. In Anchorage, I'm Zechariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future that delivers oil today and sustains operations for tomorrow. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Support for Alaska Public Media comes from First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbaalaska.com.
The Alaska Marine Highway System's largest ferry needs work on one of its propellers. The 500-passenger Columbia will soon head to a Portland, Oregon shipyard for repairs. As a result, most of Southeast Alaska's larger cities will lose one or two port calls a week. Sitka will go 2 full weeks without ferry service. Marine Highway spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says crews noticed a vibration last week when the ferry ran at full speed. Divers then inspected the ship's two propellers during a stop in Wrangell.
They noticed that on one of the blades of the starboard propeller had a noticeable bend to it where it looked like it had been hit by something. Assumption is maybe a submerged log or something along those lines that could do some damage to a large propeller like that.
The Columbia is sailing a delayed schedule through September 25th before heading to Portland for repairs. Woodrow says the Columbia continues using both its propellers, but the damage to one means its maximum speed is 13 knots, too slower than its regular rate of travel. Communities affected are Haines, Skagway, Juneau, Sitka, Petersburg, Wrangell, Ketchikan, and Bellingham, Washington. Woodrow says budget cuts mean no other ferries are available to fill in.
The soonest the Columbia is likely to come back into service is going to be Friday, October 7th, if repairs go as planned in Portland.
The Columbia is more than 40 years old. A peaceful gathering took place Monday afternoon in Saxman in support of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and to protest the Dakota Access Pipeline. But speakers expressed concerns beyond what is happening in North Dakota. KRBD's Maria Dudzak attended and has this report.
More than 50 people held protest signs while about a dozen more watched and joined in on rally cheers. The event initially was organized only to protest the pipeline project, but organized Village of Saxman President Lee Wallace says it expanded to address local and regional environmental issues.
Like our environmental issues, there are many. There's transboundary issues. Right in Saxman here, we got Deer Mountain. And then for our southern brothers and sisters, At Standing Rock Sioux, we definitely stand behind them.
A planned section of the Dakota Access Pipeline would cross sacred sites and burial places, and the Sioux tribe is concerned that, if the pipe ruptured, it would pollute drinking water. Locally, Alaska Mental Health Trust announced that it would log Deer Mountain if a land exchange or other agreement cannot be reached by the end of the year. There are also concerns about the effects of Canadian mining on Alaska fisheries and water quality. Between speakers, the crowd chanted,
"Water is life! Water is life!"
Richard Peterson, president of Tlingit and Haida Central Council, says he's been asked why Alaskans should be concerned about what's happening in the Dakotas. Peterson says it's important that Indigenous people stick together.
We're on the very steps of our own battle. And I don't think people are even fully aware of the impacts of what these transboundary mines are doing to our people, to our resources, to our way of life. And so we're going to be asking our brothers and sisters, our allies across the nation, to stand with us before long.
Peterson says natives and non-natives need to work together to protect the land and waters.
Stay with Standing Rock.
Rob Sanderson, first vice president of the Tlingit and Haida Central Council, shared his concerns about transboundary mining.
It's not the big events that will happen in Southeast Alaska, as I've learned. It's the smaller events that come from these mines that will hurt us. You take this Taku River, the Tuscarora Chief, poison since 1957 when they closed it down. Still leaching acid-generated tailings today.
Sanderson encouraged people to educate themselves and do their own research about local environmental issues. Richard Jackson of Ketchikan Indian Community says it's important to fight for and stand behind the things you believe in.
So when you do these things like stand with Standing Rock, stand with Deer Mountain, stand with what we value for health and wellness, then we can look at ourselves and say we did the best we can. It's only the person who stands back and says nothing should be what I call ashamed of themselves for not doing anything.
Monday's rally outside the Saxman Tribal House was arranged on short notice. The group plans to hold a larger rally next week in downtown Ketchikan. In Ketchikan, I'm Maria Dudzak.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes, Ellen Lockyer, Elizabeth Harbaugh, and Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Maria Dudzak in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Eric Bork is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program. Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
The Alaska Public Radio Network builds bridges of communication between urban and rural Alaska. APRN, covering the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.